coming from an ed tech background, of course, we've invested in several startups, but I've also seen a lot of startups in the ed tech space. And I mean, I'd have to say that it has to be Byju's, because really, when they came to me for investment, sometime around the early 2016 timeframe, they were a very small and fledgling company. And we're in 2021, and they're at a $14, $15 billion valuation. I don't think anybody could have imagined 5 years ago that every other advertisement that you see on TV is that of an edtech firm.
Hello everyone, Ashok here. Thank you for tuning into this 16th episode of Indian Startup Stories, a podcast thriving to bring out experiences and insights from entrepreneurs across India. Today, our guest is Monica Kapadia Mehta, EVP of Vadhvani Foundation, NEN, called National Entrepreneurship Network, a global foundation which is the backbone in accelerating various startups and turning them into high-impact companies with their coaching, mentoring, and incubation programs. Apart from her role in Vadhvani Foundation, Monica is also an investor, serial entrepreneur, and advisor for multiple startups. In this episode, Monica shares her background, passion in multiple roles, how Vadhvani Foundation is enabling students and graduates to pursue entrepreneurship at early age, job seeking versus job creation, potential conflicts and resolution between entrepreneurs and investors, contribution of women entrepreneurs to the economy, and much more valuable information for us to take away. So without further ado, let's jump in. Hi, Monica. It's wonderful to have you on this show. Thank you for coming on Indian Startup Stories today. Welcome.
Ashok, really great to be here. Thank you for having me on the show, and it's my pleasure.
That's my pleasure too. Thank you. Monica, you are mentoring multiple startups, advisors for many. And let's start with your initial days. Please share about your academic background and your career, initial career days, how it was.
Sure. So started off as a young student that did my BCom, which is the Bachelor of Commerce and Master of Commerce here in Mumbai, where I'm domiciled. While I was doing my MCom, I decided that, I wanted to start working. So didn't have much of a clue of what I really wanted to do with my career. But my first job, that I forayed into was as an equity analyst with ASK Raymond James. And during that time, realized that, there was a lot more to investment banking. So kind of moved over then to the debt side. So after equities, I kind of traded in debt for a while. So between, my years at ASK Raymond James and Dara Show, I think I spent about 4 or 4.5 years. And after that, I decided that, maybe investment banking is not exactly what I want to do. So I decided to go and grab an MBA in the US. And I was studying at Thunderbird in Phoenix, Arizona. And it was a global MBA. So it really gave me insights into not only, management concepts, but I realized how fun learning can be. And for me, my experience in India during my undergraduate and graduate years of education were not as, they were very enjoyable outside of the classroom, but I felt like the learning had been minimal. But I really enjoyed my time in the US study. So I decided to come back and decided to go into the entrepreneurial route and become an education entrepreneur for the first 9 years, because I really wanted to bring back the best practices from the US and really wanted to see how I can make education as a journey more enjoyable for students here. So when I came back, I was an education entrepreneur for the first 9 years, and that's how my journey began.
Okay, that's a great start and a great thought process as well. Nice, wonderful. Please talk about the company Vadhvani Foundation, the NEN within that, and how it helps people, companies, and must-know information for people about the foundation too.
Absolutely. So Vadhvani Foundation is, our founder Romesh Vadhvani's endowment, which he wants to use towards job creation. So the vision of the foundation is job creation. He himself has been a successful tech entrepreneur of Indian origin, but based in the US in the Bay Area, and has had many successful tech companies to his credit. His tech companies are called the Symphony Technology Group. And having been a successful tech entrepreneur, he realized how fun and empowering an entrepreneurial journey can be, but at the same time, how challenging it can be, right? And very often, you're a single person, single founder. It's a very lonely journey. You can really be very lost if you don't have the right kind of support, mentoring, know-how, all of that, right? And with that in mind, you know, he set up Vadhvani Foundation to service to entrepreneurs by supporting them in their journey. And he believes that entrepreneurship is the best way to create jobs. And in a country like India, I think, you know, job creation is so important, because if most of our population is job seekers, then we will not really be able to create jobs. So the more people that decide to get into entrepreneurship as a journey and decide to really, you know, create young startups or young ventures. So that is really the genesis of Vadhvani Foundation and why it was set up and what our founder wanted to do. So at Vadhvani Foundation, we have several initiatives. I will just talk a little bit about the others before I come to the one that I lead and what we do. One of the ones is Vadhvani Advantage. This is a program that supports young, small and medium-sized business to really, you know, scale through a consulting kind of program where we handhold and support them and really help them to understand where their gaps are and how we can help them scale. The other one is Vadhvani Opportunity, where we really, it's a skilling-based program, and we've got a lot of different programs that help students through both soft skills as well as hard skills in various domain spaces. We work closely with several state governments and the NSDC to deliver these programs to the absolute bottom of the pyramid. Vadhvani Venture Fast Track is another program we have, where we support young and growth stage ventures through incubators and accelerators. So these are incubation and acceleration programs that we have, both directly as well as ones where we run them through other incubators and accelerators. And then there is a Vadhvani NEN, which is the National Entrepreneurship Network, which is the one that I lead. And the National Entrepreneurship Network is our oldest and our legacy program that began in 2005. Here, the aim is to inspire lots of young students across the country. Now, of course, we are also globally in about 16, 17 countries. But coming back to India, you know, the aim is to pan-India, inspire young students who are currently in college but are about to graduate, and kind of get them excited about, like I mentioned earlier, about taking up entrepreneurship as a possible career option as opposed to being a job seeker, being a job creator. So towards that effect, then, we have two courses that we run through colleges. One is the foundational course and the other one is the advanced course. And both these courses are a semester long. And we run these in about 100 colleges across India, including some IIMs and IITs, but also with tier 2 and tier 3 colleges in, you know, smaller cities across India. So we have a pan-India presence. We have about 15 to 20,000 students that go through our programs today per year. And of course, we hope to scale them in the future. What we really do is, while the course is being run by the college faculty that we train, and they you know, use it through our LMS, through our technology platform and our content, we also have a very strong 360-degree support program that we help students with. So when they start this course, they start with what we call a practice venture. The course is not theoretical. You actually have to start a venture, and you have to have two or three co-founders when you start a program. And we handhold you through the entire journey of entrepreneurship and tell you how to ideate to how to create a minimum viable product in our foundational course. In our advanced course, we then take them from our minimum viable product to a real venture. So when you finish our two courses, you actually have a real venture with real revenues, real customers. We actually handhold you through that. So while all of that happens in the classroom, our 360-degree program involves masterclasses, expert intervention, booster clinics, everything we can do to really support and handhold the student to be as successful as they can be, and, you know, and have sustainable ventures beyond the time they are with us. We also have a very, very strong Mentor Connect program, so that while students are going through this journey, one of the things that I again mentioned earlier is that it can be a very lonely journey sometimes, when sometimes you're looking to, you know, get an answer to some questions you might have, or you're not really sure which way to head. You're kind of stuck at a junction and you need a mentor to really help and support you in trying to figure out what's the best path forward, or, you know, give you some advice. And so our Mentor Connect program really helps our students to connect with mentors that we have on an app, and, you know, get time with them and really speak to them and, you know, get advice on some of their issues, challenges, you know, future thoughts that they might have for their startup. So this is how we help students to come up with real ventures. And last but not the least, then, the last part of it is our ecosystem development program. So beyond the time that they finish this course with us, we want to make sure that, you know, we help them with either funding or help them with incubation or help them to, you know, really continue to their path. So we have a lot of ecosystem partners like AWS, you know, RuPay and, you know, RazorPay. So we really help them to kind of, or rather, let me say, we really handhold them to ensure that even beyond the time that they're with us, they get funded, incubated and supported in having a successful venture.
Wonderful. That's a massive objective and a huge vision, actually, to starting with the initial advantage or opportunity for students, or be it yearly startup founders with Venture Fast Track along with Mentor Connects. Wonderful objectives and a great thought process. Let's take a bit by bit. You are in a various role. You are performing as an angel investor, as a mentor, and also core into edtech. So as an angel investor, when you discuss with startup founders having new ideas or products, what are the qualities you look for and what are the priorities that goes into those discussions?
You know, so whether it's an whether I choose to come on board as an advisor or a mentor to a startup, or whether I, you know, choose to be an angel investor on the startup, I think my excitement is in, you know, funding and supporting very early stage startups, right? So pretty much at that time, they have started with an idea, they've kind of, you know, come up with some kind of a minimum viable product, maybe they have their first initial revenues, right? And at that time, it's hard to predict where the company's going to head. So for me, the most important aspect of any company that, you know, I choose to work with or choose to invest in is the team. I think that is critical for a very young startup. In many cases, it's a single co-founder, but in several cases also, these are, you know, co-founders. Just trying to understand whether between them, they cover all aspects of what a startup needs to be successful, just in terms of attributes and strengths. If not, whether they have team members that bring in those attributes. So I've seen oftentimes, you know, all the two or three co-founders are techies, right? So technology is covered, right? But sometimes they don't have an understanding of business development, or sometimes they don't have an understanding of what the market opportunity looks like. They're just in love with their product, but they haven't thought through all the other aspects. In many cases, you know, maybe I've seen founders who are great business development people, but they really haven't thought through what the pain point for the customer is and whether the product is solving for the pain point. So I really like to dive deep into the team. And for me, if the team is really great, I believe that even if the product or the service doesn't work, they will quickly pivot. They will quickly try to see, you know, what's the next best thing we can do? How can we change some things to really suit the customer? So I think the team is critically important. They need to have certain attributes of a good, robust startup team. The second thing that I look for really is the market opportunity of, you know, the product or the service that they're trying to come up with, right? Or they have come up with. Because oftentimes, again, like I said, they're in love with their product, but they haven't thought through whether there is truly a market opportunity. And when I say that, it's really, are you truly solving the pain point of your customer, right? And, you know, if you know that you're truly solving for a pain point of a customer, you've gone out there, you've done some surveys, talk to a bunch of people in your target segment, and you really are aware of whether this is a nice to have product or a need to have product. Then you know, you know that if it's a need to have product, it's a large market opportunity out there. And for me, that's the second thing that I really look for. And the third thing that I think beyond that for a very early stage startup is then really what is the solution, right? Which is the product or the service itself. And while there might be a great pain point out there, I've oftentimes seen young entrepreneurs fail only because they haven't thought through what exactly is the best solution to that, to solving that pain point. So those are the three things that I really, you know, like to see or look for in a young stage. Venture and entrepreneur.
Okay, very precise. Yeah, though hardcore techies actually do a lot of startup, but there is always a gap when it comes to go-to-market strategy and how they take in terms of prioritization, sales and marketing and stuff. Wonderful. So I want to understand which formula of time management has actually worked for you in switching multiple roles, being a board of advisory and also mentoring a lot of startups and also into the venture capitalist things. So what is your formula of time management?
For me, I think it's just been a prioritization. If I have to just put it in one simple word, right? So there are always plenty of things to do. There's always not enough time in the day. Everyone's gifted with 24 hours, but it always seems less, given all of the amount of things we want to do. So if I have a task for the day list, I ask myself at the start of the day, okay, what are the critical items I really need to get done for nothing to go haywire, right? There are some things that are always like must get done, and there are always some things that it'll be nice to get done today. So I try and get everything done, but almost always I want to make sure that I check the boxes of the things that have to get done. Again, oftentimes I think that, you know, I try and think of things not in terms of activities, as much I think of them in terms of things that are strategic areas that need my input, right? So if I know that a particular company that I'm advising, for example, needs support with business development, for me, I know that the action item is that I need to kick open a couple of doors for them to kind of introduce them to people through which some of their, you know, biz dev work can start getting kicked off, right? And so I know that if biz dev is the top priority, that's what I need to do. They may have a second thing that they want me to do, for example, which is perhaps introduce them to somebody from a technology field to really test their product and see whether it's viable the way it is or, you know, whether it needs some upgrade. And if I feel that that can wait, then that goes on to the next week, right? Because I know that I have got to really focus on those couple of areas where they really need my utmost input. And it's similar at work, right? I mean, I just know that there are two or three things that really need my attention for that day or for that week. And then I just focus on those things. So I can't be dishonest. I don't get everything I want to get done every day on a daily basis. But I definitely get done one of the most important things that I need to get done for that day on a daily basis.
Okay, list prioritization. Wonderful. In the vision of Vadhvani Foundation, the dream is big, bringing up high potential startups. So can you share about few of the instances which you remember, like the startups which has really surprised you in terms of its growth?
Yeah. So I think, you know, coming from an edtech background, of course, we've invested in several startups, but, you know, I've also seen a lot of startups in the edtech space. And I mean, I'd have to say that it has to be Byju's, because really, when they came to me for investment sometime around the early 2016 timeframe, they were a very small and fledgling company. And we're in 2021. And they're at a $14, $15 billion valuation. And, I don't think anybody could have imagined 5 years ago that every other advertisement that you see on TV is that of an edtech firm, you know? I mean, Byju's, Upgrad, Unacademy. I mean, our Indian cricket team is sponsored by Byju. You know? And for me, that's been like, you know, I mean, not only are they a unicorn, they're just like really large today, and they've acquired a lot of Indian edtech companies, but they've also acquired some non-Indian companies sitting out of the US and other geographies. So I think that for me has been the biggest jump that I've seen in the past 5 years.
Wonderful. So connecting to your previous three aspects that you look into any startups, right? Be it the team or what problem they are solving in order bridging the gap with the solution. So what quality you saw in Byju or some of the unicorns now, but in the very earlier stage, what were the big positives that you have seen among those top guys now?
Yeah. So I think, again, if I'm, referring to the example that I gave in terms of Byju's and other large edtech companies, I think one of the things is that they created a market that didn't exist, right? Typically, when I saw education companies about 7-8 years ago, most of them were selling into schools. Very few of them were selling into parents, right? And so just like so many other industries have moved from B2B to B2C, and they're really their, you know, end consumers are being directly targeted. That is what a lot of these new age edtech unicorns started to target, right? They targeted the parents directly, and they started to directly address the parents with their needs. White Hat Junior is another example, right? I mean, it's a coding boot camp and teaches kids coding. But really, reaching out to the parents saying, you know, I believe that your child will be left out if you do not subscribe to White Hat Junior for your child, right? The future lies in coding. The future lies in technology. Your child must be conversant with technology. So I feel that they went after a market that didn't exist, Like, there was no competitor to White Hat Junior when they started. There was no competitor to Byju's when they started and talked about curriculum online, right? That their kids could avail of after school. We had the tuitions, but these were all offline. And they went after a market that didn't exist. What they really saw is a market opportunity that existed but had not really been thought through or had not really been created. And they were actually creators of a large market opportunity.
Okay, that's wonderful. I generally ask these questions for yearly startups, but I'm trying to fit in how it is applicable for the foundation. Any startup, when they are starting, initially managing funds and getting to know about how to manage their fund, whatever they are having, or in case of bringing in extra venture capitalist. So how was the initial days for the foundation? What are the challenges it has gone through and how it has handled as a foundation forming this, bringing a lot of startups to actually boost up?
So from a funding standpoint, Ashok, look, I feel that bootstrapping is the best way to go. A lot of young founders, you know, in the quest for raising funds and in the quest for trying to manage their funds, sometimes get into what I call the problem of plenty, right? You have an investor, the angel investor, seed fund, whatever, investing in you. And then you just get completely sucked into this whole vicious cycle of spending large amounts of money, whether it's for customer acquisition or whether it's for, you know, product upgradation or whatever the case might be. And I think that young founders, you know, and we do this at the foundation too. We don't fund them. We support them with getting funders to fund them. But we always explain to them that bootstrapping and managing your funds well is a very key concept that they need to learn very early on. Because there are always 15 things you want to spend on as a young founder. And obviously, there is less money than what you want always. And there is many more things you want to spend on. But again, it comes back to prioritization, right? You know that for your 100 rupees, what is the best bang for the buck that you can get? Where, when you spend that 100 rupees, can you get the most out of it? And that is something that's not only a part of our courses, but even through our mentorship, we really deep dive into this with our young students, telling them that you will always want to spend on plenty of things. There'll always be a few things that you can spend on. And it's all about prioritizing on those and then deciding what are the most important things to spend on.
Okay, nice. So currently, what are the types of startups that are being benefited? Is it being a domain specific, as you spoke about EdTech, or you have any filter criteria to start with for the startups?
No. At Vadhvani Foundation, my background has been in EdTech before the foundation, which is why I gave some examples. But we take startups from across all disciplines.
Okay.
So we are sector agnostic, so to speak. In fact, we have an idea bank. And that idea bank contains ideas from all sorts of domains and industries. So whether it's EdTech, FinTech, AgriTech, HealthTech, e-commerce, I mean, we're open to everything. Manufacturing, offline, online businesses, anything. We do have students who are in colleges from tier 1, tier 2 cities. So sometimes when you look at students in tier 2 and tier 3 colleges and cities, very often they're trying to address a very important problem in their local communities, you know. So these are not these tech-enabled businesses that are, you know, that are trying to go after the broader community, right? They're solving for a smaller community problem that they see in their local regional communities. And we want to support those businesses too, because that's the Bharat, right? We're not talking about just the India, the unicorns and the large tech-enabled businesses. We're also talking about the small businesses that you want to enable, because they also need the know-how to run their businesses successfully in their small communities.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. Thank you. Discussing on the same funding part, can you elaborate what are the different aspects or the types of funding that a startup can actually avail for? There are a lot of varieties, right? Being it grants or pre-seeding and different stages of seed fundings. So can you a little bit elaborate on what are the different types lying on the table?
Sure. So I think for a very early stage startup, the best way to bring in funds is through friends and family, right? And that's what you call angel investors. Today, there is so many avenues for bringing in angel investment. Oftentimes, there are crowdfunding platforms through which angel investors invest. You know, there are forums like Mumbai Angels, Chennai Angels, and, you know, that they're actually out there to help young businesses with investments. There are groups of, young investors that come together and say, you know, I mean, we're going to invest in these two or three avenues. of investment. So there are lots of different ways that you can actually invest through these angel investor channels, right? So I think young startups can definitely look at angel investors as one channel. There are also a lot of incubation centers today, right? And these are all Atal Innovation Mission funded incubators that have been set up to not only incubate companies and support them with various tools and resources, but also to fund them, right? So if you get absorbed into an incubator, then that's a great way of not only getting some support and help in understanding the vision and how to go ahead with your company and your startup, but it's also a great way to get funded because incubators often are the first funders for their incubatees, so to speak. And then today you have a lot of funds out there that are debt funds, not necessarily funds for equity. So, if you are sure that you just need short-term financing and, you can also go in for debt. You don't always have to partake of equity because when you're a young company, if you part with equity for the finance that's put in, you normally have a much lower valuation in the initial days. So you'd have to part with a lot more equity. So debt funding could also be a really good option. And I think those are, initial options that companies can go with. Last but not the least, social entrepreneurs, there's also a lot of grants, right? If you're in the impact sectors, there are incubators that specialize in social entrepreneurs. There are non-for-profits and large, funders that focus on grant funding, social entrepreneurs that are looking to support areas that are, in need of support. Like, during COVID, there were so many people that came forward for healthcare and hygiene and, those kind of things. And then there's a lot of grant funding that's available as well.
Yeah, I guess grant stands separate because they don't get into the equity stuff with the companies, right?
Yes.
Okay. You must be having very strong and big team for the foundation. So how big is the actual team on the ground? And what is the strategy of building the team within Vadhvani?
Yes. So overall at the foundation, we are about a 200 plus strong organization. The National Entrepreneurship Network that I lead in India, we are about 17 people at the India team level. But I do look after Southeast Asia and MENA as well. So with all of our global NEN team members put together, NEN globally, including Latin America, Africa, etc., we should be about 40, 45 people on the ground.
Wonderful. As an advisor, what is that you feel when a company should go for an IPO? Some may start thinking very early stage with a lot of fundings backed by the VCs. So from your point of view, what is that one recommendation in terms of be it a timeline or any target that they have achieved with a lot of customers? So what's your take on that?
Yeah. So IPOs, are not that easy to come by, right? I mean, you only want to go IPO when you've reached a certain level of revenue, when you've reached a certain level of traction in your business. Because unless you're of a certain size, liquidity becomes really hard, right, on the stock exchanges and the bourses. So I would say that, there are obviously three or four ways of exiting a business, right? One is, of course, when large VCs have backed you, they want an IPO so that they can exit because otherwise they don't have a way to exit. And oftentimes there are larger VCs or strategic buyers that also want to buy off the business if that is of strategic value to them, right? If the business you're running is of strategic value to them. So I think IPO is definitely one way of looking at an exit or, enhancing your business value. But I think that there are other ways and it all depends on what size you are, what size you reach, and oftentimes what kind of, understanding you've reached with your investors. Because oftentimes investors have already put that in to your documents when you sign them, saying that they will take you to an IPO when they feel the time is right. And in that case, you don't have a choice but to go with it, right? I think you would weigh your options before deciding an IPO, depending on what is the best value for you for your business.
Okay. On that same line, when you said that there will be terms, sometimes it says that this is the time business thinks that they should go for an IPO. Many founders and VCs, generally they'll have different kinds of opinion and founders may want to actually hold on for the product to go really big and not ready for IPO. Can you share some instances that you've seen? What are the crucial conflicts that have come with the founders and the VCs and how are they handled, be it in terms of a clause and terms?
Yeah. So, you know, on a broader level, Ashok, I'm going to start by saying that really good quality, prudent investors leave it for the entrepreneur to run the business because they know that he or she knows best as to what's going on the ground. And while they do advice at the board level, they do give some suggestions, they do support the entrepreneur in whatever ways they can, they leave it for the entrepreneur to really run the business, or the co-founders, if there are more than one, to run the business. And they are prudent enough to not really interfere, right, in how the founder should run the business. But, you know, oftentimes I think that, you know, founders also get into the habit of not pushing back, right? Sometimes you've got to push back with your investor and tell them, well, I know this is what you're suggesting. I know this is what you want me to do. But I believe that I understand the business. These are the reasons why I'm making these decisions. And I believe you should let me continue down the path because I understand the pulse of the market. I understand the market that I'm in. The other kind of conflicts, obviously, that is about running the business, the operation side of the business kind of conflicts, right? And how you can solve them. But obviously, then there are the conflicts that arise from exits, conflict that arise from, you know, new rounds of, you know, financing, and where there's been an understanding, but the promoter wants one thing, the investor wants another. And I'm going to say that, you know, I think a lot of this is dependent on market dynamics. So, for example, in the past 1 year or 1.5 years, we've been through a pandemic year, right? So many things changed. Nobody was aware that this is going to happen. It came as a surprise to a lot of people. Nobody had planned for this contingency, right? So I think investors have to understand, and founders have to understand too, that, you know, conflict resolution is a really important piece of this, to not destroy the business. Because if things didn't go as planned, it's not because the founder didn't do well, or it's not because the investor wasn't supportive. It's just because there were macroeconomic factors that were in nobody's control. So I think conflict resolution through arbitration, or through, you know, just a intermediary that can really help the two sides to kind of come together on the table and say, well, okay, there's a conflict either on the exit side or on the new round financing side or on the valuation side or on, you know, salary for the promoter side. It could be so many areas of conflicts that I've seen, right? But it's all about conflict resolution. Because once the investor-entrepreneur relationship gets soured, it's really hard for work to happen. And then everything gets derailed into conflict as opposed to the focus being on actually growing the business. So if both people really want the business to grow and want the focus to be on growing the business, then it's important to keep the conflict in a space where, you know, you want to resolve the conflict as opposed to get into a full-blown war. That's what I feel.
Okay. That's wonderful information. Moving on to certain aspects of advisors, right? Because you are being advisor to many boards. What are the general responsibilities that come in being an advisor for a company?
Sure. So in the role that I've played as an advisor, and most of these have been very young startups, again, Ashok. So I'm not going to speak for large growth stage startups or large companies. I'm going to speak for young startups where I've worked. Pretty much every area that you can imagine is the help they need on, right? And it depends from founder to founder. So I have supported founders, like I said, if they've been a bunch of technology, geeks who really understand technology well and have built out a beautiful product, it's often been on the human resource side to bring in other people who can balance out their skills, you know, and can bring in more business development, finance, really quant-related skills. I've seen founders who have got great business development skills, and I've brought in experience and expertise on the technology side, on the finance side. There are oftentimes teams that are really good with, you know, fundraising, the finance, the valuation, and all of those things. They've got a good, you know, consulting and finance background, or sometimes an investment banking background. But they do lack skills in, you know, identifying the market opportunity, really figuring out who the customer is, what the pain point is, and whether they're really going after that in the right way. And so I've helped on those sides. So everything from human resource to finance and fundraising to marketing and business development, to technology. I mean, these are all the different kinds of areas that I've supported startups with. And, you know, an advisor's role at a young startup age and stage can be anything. It's not restricted to, sometimes it's personal, you know, a founder finds himself or herself really lonely, and they really want to just have a mentor who can really understand their issues and just be more like a guide and a friend to them. You know, it's not specifically to do with marketing. They're just really tired of this journey. Things have not gone right. They've not gone well. And they just need someone to push them and say, you know what, let's do these few things and I'm sure things will turn around. Just give them that additional mentoring and support to make them feel like they have somebody there that's supporting them. So it's a wide range of things.
Okay, just curious, because being advisor to multiple companies, how do you manage a day when priorities come with multiple companies?
Yeah, so I have to say that every day, it's not every company that needs you, right?
True.
It's always in phases. Some companies fundraising, so they really need your support because they're trying to figure out how to talk to the investor, what kind of valuation should they ask from the investor, what sort of conversation should they get into with the investor on this? Another time, a company is launching a new product, and when they're launching a new product, they want me to support them with, okay, so what do you think is the best marketing strategy? We have a digital marketing firm and they've given us this plan. Do you think we should do X or we should do Y? But in general, what I've noticed is that it's rarely been a situation where all of the companies are needing my time all at the same time. And when those things happen, then I have 2 or 3 sleepless days, right? I mean, it's just like I'm literally sleeping and surviving on, you know, maybe 4 hours of sleep. So those times do come, but those are few and far between. Most of the times I know that this company is going in for a fundraise and this week this is a priority. So if I'm having like a full-time position like I do at Vadvani Foundation and I'm mentoring and advising 4 or 5 young startups, you know, and I'm an angel investor on one startup, between all of that, I normally am able to manage my time well, knowing who is the priority for that week. And it's rarely happened that all of them come in as priorities. And when that does, I just compromise on sleep.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah. So now Vadvani Foundation, National Entrepreneurship Network, it is huge now. Just wanted to recollect on how it was earlier. What was the first moment of relief when you started Vadvani since the inception? Is it from any customer success, be it a small, bringing up a small startup, or what was the first moment of relief?
So I think in 2005, when Vadvani Foundation first began, and I wasn't at the foundation then, but from what I understand from, you know, my predecessors and people who've been with the foundation since the inception, is that initially in 2005, entrepreneurship in India itself was not a concept very well understood, right? So the initial challenge was just get people to understand what entrepreneurship is, why is it important, why do people need to even learn entrepreneurship concepts. Look, in India, we've had our forefathers run entrepreneurial businesses, right? Nobody went and taught them how entrepreneurship works and, you know, how you run a business. They somehow just, you know, managed it on their own and they learned along the way through successes and failures, right? So it was, I think the hardest part in the beginning was to really get people to understand that entrepreneurship is important and it's something that you can learn. It's a journey that you can, you know, actually get help on, etc. And I think the pivotal moment was when not only did large corporates understand the importance of entrepreneurship, but colleges, the government, and everyone came together. You know, today we have a startup policy in the country. We have the government backing startups. We have corporates backing startups. We have investors backing startups. Like, that entire ecosystem has developed. And I think sometime around the 2011-12 timeframe is when that pivot happened. When then our courses had a pull factor. Earlier, it was always push, push, push. We were going to colleges saying, hey, you should take our entrepreneurship courses. They're really great and great for your students. Today, there's a pull factor because almost all colleges, good colleges in India, have an incubation center. They have an accelerator on campus. They're helping their students to start startups. And they want people like ourselves who can support young startups who understand, you know, entrepreneurship education and entrepreneurship knowledge dissemination. And they want to partner with us. So I think that is a pivotal moment of change for us when all of the ecosystem came together. And now it's just a pull factor. You know, we don't have to push anything.
Okay, moving from push factor to pull factor. It's a great leap. Nice. Monica, you also encourage women entrepreneurs and you are already laying foundation. You have successful use cases in that line. Can you share the importance and the contribution that women entrepreneurs are making for the economy today? Any stats, please?
Absolutely. So, you know, I believe that COVID has done one really good thing for women entrepreneurs where it's evident today that you don't have to travel far distances, or you don't have to really physically move out too far to, you know, run a successful business, right? Because initially, I feel, you know, when you talk of women entrepreneurs, before I move into, you know, what contribution they can make, what are their challenges, right? Why do so many women choose not to go down the entrepreneur route? Oftentimes, it's, you know, social constraints. Oftentimes, a lot of them are young parents. They don't want to get out of their homes. They don't want to go very far. They want to give that kind of time to their family. So it's the entire work-life balance. On another side, they may not have the social support system that can enable them to go out there and pursue their dreams of entrepreneurship. On another note, many of them don't feel financially capable, right? Because they don't have the financial wherewithal or the financial support from family and friends, you know, husbands, parents, in-laws, whatever the case might be, to actually undertake that route. So I feel that those are constraints. Now, on the physical constraint side, I think COVID has really shown that you can do this from the comfort of your home, right? Whether it's a small food business or a small fashion business or a small teaching business, you can actually do it from the comfort of your home. So that's given a lot of empowerment to women to actually start their businesses. We run special cohorts for women entrepreneurs at Vadhvani Foundation. There are a lot of others that have actually undertaken women entrepreneurship very seriously. There is something called the STEP, which is Shakti, the Empathy Project, that only does women cohorts for incubation. There are so many other incubators in India that focus on women entrepreneurship. So they are actually creating programs that have all of the elements of an incubation program, but they add more elements to the program that are specific to women. And some of them I mentioned, the challenges that I just mentioned a little while ago. They ensure that they talk to women about those challenges, about getting out of their, you know, their comfort zone and actually not thinking about all the constraints, but using those constraints as actual, you know, opportunities to move forward. So a lot of these programs have come forward. And because of all of this, you know, I think the funding towards women entrepreneurship is also gaining momentum. You have funds like All Funds Achieving Women Entrepreneurs that only focus on, you know, focus on investing in women-led or women-enabled businesses, right? So the entire ecosystem is now coming to a full circle to support women entrepreneurs. I think from an economic standpoint, India stands to gain tremendously. And I think if we can get a lot of our women folk, I unfortunately don't have the numbers right now in front of me, but I know that we can contribute to this, you know, several trillion dollar economy that our Prime Minister keeps talking about and the government keeps mentioning. I think women can play a very, very strong role in that towards that step. So I think that it's looking good to me. A lot of people in the ecosystem are coming together. I think as women ourselves, we need to now put that foot forward and believe in ourselves and make that happen.
Okay, that's great to know. What's the moment of opportunity you found during this challenging year that we sailed through, being as an individual for you and also being a leader for the organization?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the first thing that COVID taught us is that you don't need people in offices all the time, right? It's okay for people to be at their homes, and we can have workaround solutions for them to work where they are. So I think for me, the shift in my mindset was that you don't need to have an office full of people, right? Because earlier we would expect people to be there at a certain time. You would expect them to be there for a certain number of hours. That was just the way things worked. I think the biggest mindset shift was that, you know, as long as he or she is delivering on what we need them to deliver, it really does not matter whether they worked at 9 a.m. in the morning or 3 p.m. in the afternoon. As long as they can balance their lives and still get what needs to get done for the foundation and for the team, you know, it's good enough, right? For me personally, as a leader, that was a mindset shift that, you know, I was very flexible with the team about how they wanted to spend the day, what they wanted to do. But I also realized as a leader that COVID brought about this immense need for anytime, anywhere working, right? Because at least in office, when you left office at 6:30 in the evening, it was like there was a change in mind that, okay, I'm now going home. And so I'm expected to not be in office and working. But because it was all work from home, everybody started working pretty much 10 hours a day. So we decided...
Yeah, the boundary has disappeared.
Yeah. So we decided to bring in one day in a week. You know, like Thursday was no call day. So nobody was expected to be on any team calls. Those were days when, you know, you could do a personal errand, you wanted to do just emails, you wanted to do whatever you needed to do to, you know, kind of calm your life and bring it back to some kind of because Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays and Fridays, we would have calls from 9 a.m. to like 7 p.m. We don't even have like a break for lunch sometimes. So we decided to put in a break lunch, a break for, you know, maybe half an hour for just refreshments and tea in the evening, just so that we have put in that into people's calendars. Otherwise, the calendars are open and people are just, you know, pushing in calls through the day. So just about how to bring out that life balance, you know, we kind of came up with some ideas.
Okay. Now calendars are getting filled because we don't have that commuting hours. So extra hours for work is also there. Any instances of mistakes that you have done so far? And if yes, what are the learnings you felt that it is more valuable than compared to the smooth sailing days?
Yeah, so many failures that I can think about right through my career. I think from my investment, I mean, the investment part of my career, made a lot of mistakes in investing in the wrong companies. A lot of them have either shut down or we were not able to get the desired valuations on exits. And I think the biggest learning there has been the quality of the founder, which is why when you asked me what is the top two or three things you look for, you know, in a startup team when you either want to invest or you want to advise and, you know, help the startup. And I said team is the most important. I think the biggest mistakes I've made have been surrounding identifying the right founder, spending enough time with the founder to really understand what drives the founder, whether they are the right people to back, right people to invest with, right people to spend time supporting, right? And all of our biggest failures during our investment years, both when I was at Kaizen and at Omidyar Network, have come from not investing in the right founders. And I think that the other thing, again, from my investment standpoint, before I moved to my entrepreneurial journey, is really understanding whether there is a market opportunity. And that requires a lot more time and effort, right? It's not just, you know, looking at some secondary research and doing some arbitrary statistical work. It's a lot of data analytics that needs to go into it, right? To really understand that for a product, is there truly a market opportunity out there? It needs you to actually go out there to the market, understand, you know, think through the product. It requires thematic research, you know, understanding whether it's a white space. And if you are creating a market that doesn't exist, does it have future potential? And I think that was a second lesson for me. That was a learning, because we did invest in products that were either ahead of their time or did not have the market that we believed that we had for them, right? Which is why that was the second thing I said to you when I look for in a startup, that are they really solving for a must-have need? You know, that's really important. Mm. And I think as an entrepreneur myself, because my first 9 years in education were as an education entrepreneur, and as I, you know, help startups, I think really defining who your customer is and what you're trying to do, right? As an entrepreneur, I myself realized that oftentimes I missed out on targets or missed out on doing what I had set out to do is because I hadn't well defined my journey and what I was going to do. And, you know, maybe there I'd like to take the Uber example because, you know, it's easy for people to understand because most people use Uber, and those that will be listening to your podcast. I think that when it decided, in the early part of its journey to figure out what is it that they're really trying to do for their customers, when they went in with the current model that they have, it was three things that they said, right? They said, you will never need to own a wallet. You will never need to own a car. And you will never need directions to where you want to go. And so it was very clear as to what is it that they were trying to do for their customer. And both as an entrepreneur myself and as I help entrepreneurs on a daily basis, I realize that sometimes there is so much confusion. They want to do everything for everybody. You're in fintech, you want to help student loans, but you also want to help some company and you also want to help some corporates. And it's too many things, right? So unless you're really sure about what are the things that you're really standing for, and then go deep into that and really solve for that problem well. Because if you're trying to solve for five problems, you're a young startup with limited money, limited resources, limited people, you can't do everything for everyone. So I really think that for me, that's been a really big learning, that if you are not sure about the top two or three problems you're trying to solve for, and what is it that you really want to go deep into, then you can just get lost in a maze of ideas. Because every day a new opportunity comes up as a young startup and you get attracted to it. But you sometimes have to stand your ground and say, no, this looks exciting, but for the next 2 years, I'm going to stick with what I've decided to do, really go deep into the market, acquire my customers, and then maybe time to think about the next thing.
Okay, yeah, that's very informative. Moving on to the personal side of it, with all these loads lying on your shoulder, keeping you engaged throughout, how do you manage your personal time and how do you keep yourself available for your family?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm 51. I've now been working for about 29, 30 years. And in those 30 years, there have been many moments of me wanting to quit. Just quit because I feel like I have two children who are now 19 and 22. But at the time that I started, they were very young. And there were many times when I felt like I was not giving them enough time. Well, I've missed so many of my daughter and son's, you know, what you call annual days or sports days, you know, important moments in their lives when you want to be there, yeah. Right? You know, I think that there are two or three ways that I at least personally balance it out. I think I have a very understanding spouse, and I think that for children, at least as long as one of their parents are always around and there to support them, they manage well. And so we've always had a good understanding in terms of, okay, if one of us can't be there, the other one needs to be there. And we've kind of balanced it both ways. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I think that's been very important in making sure that at least for my family, and when I say family, my kids mostly, one of us has always been there. I've also come to realize and I've kind of learned to explain as well as convince myself that it's never going to be perfect. So if you're looking for a perfect day, a perfect solution, a perfect situation, it's not going to be there. And I've realized that there are going to be some days when I'm going to have to put family ahead of work. And there are going to be some days when I'm going to have to put work ahead of family. And initially, those were not easy choices to make. Today, it's become very easy. I know at work when I can say, I'm sorry, but I just can't be there. I have something important happening in the family. It could be someone in the family who's elderly and needs healthcare support. It could be kids. It could be a friend who needs support, whatever the case might be, right? Or it could be my personal life that needs support. But I've learned to be able to, after many years, kind of divide that in my head, you know, like, okay, today is work day. I need to be there at work. I need those hours because something important needs to get done that will derail everything if I don't put in that effort. Because sometimes I'm the block, right? I mean, I'm the stumbling block. If I don't put that thing through, then the team can't go ahead with something. But then there are days I will wake up and say, you know what, I'll just write an email and say, sorry, I have something personal come up. I don't think I'll be available today. I need to take a personal time off. And that's it. And I don't feel guilty anymore. So I've had many years both ways. Oh, I didn't give enough to work today. Oh, I didn't give enough to my family today. And today I think I've come to a point where I live guilt-free, right? Like I couldn't give enough to work today. Fair enough. I had to give time to family. I couldn't give time to family today. It was an important occasion, but work needed me. Both ways, it's fair.
Okay. So it's the experience which is taking decision there.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So for people going through failures, what are your message? People may be trying a lot, trying to push their ideas, making it big. What are your message to them?
I think the biggest message I can give them is that when I look back, I feel I learned a lot more from my failures than successes. Because successes make you feel very happy momentarily, right? Because at that moment when you've achieved something, some kind of momentous milestone or a successful piece in your life, it feels great. So for example, let's say I got a great job somewhere or you know, I'm running a company and you know, I achieved this great order on something that I was not expected to do or you know, I achieved a partnership or something. But you never at that moment think about why you succeeded. Rarely anybody stops and says, oh, why did I succeed? How did I get to this point? You just enjoy that moment and then you're like, okay, now I want to go ahead and hit the next milestone. But I think every time I fail, I've stopped to think, why did this happen? Like, what led to this? And then when you think about that whole piece, when you fail as to what led to the failure, what could have changed things, what could have not enabled you to fail, and what could you have done things in terms of done things differently, that's when you then get to a point where the learning is immense. And so I feel for people who've failed, I always say to my kids as well, it's just a bend, it's not the end, right? So you can have, you know, one more milestone that you've hit where maybe it was a failure, but you know, there are several more milestones coming in the future which could be successful. And it's just about learning from them, getting up and, you know, being a warrior and moving ahead.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. On that same line, people having big ideas, but they are afraid to begin. What is an important quality that you expect they should possess to move on?
Look, I feel entrepreneurship is not for everyone. You know, in fact, in some of the interesting entrepreneurship courses that I've seen around the world, including at Vadvani Foundation, the first thing that they come and tell you is why you should not be an entrepreneur.
Okay.
People for whom entrepreneurship is not the right thing, right? It's just like not everybody can be a great sports person. Not everybody can be a great artist. Not everybody can be a great musician. For entrepreneurship to be a successful journey, excuse me, there are some attributes that you need to have. Risk-taking ability, an ability to persevere no matter what happens. You know, you believe in your idea, you believe in your journey, and you're going to keep going ahead. And I feel that if you have an idea, but you don't have the attributes of an entrepreneur, that you know, that you're going to do some of these things that I just said that you must have as an entrepreneur, then I think that you should let someone else run your idea. But if you want to run your idea, you must have these attributes, because it's so easy to give up. You know, when you are an entrepreneur, there are always going to be hard moments in your journey, tough moments, when, you know, you feel you want to give up, or you don't think you can carry on. And, you know, they're just like moments that make you want to quit. And those are the moments you can't quit, and you know you need to do that. So unless you have that, even if you have a great idea, I would recommend to people that they don't start unless they have certain attributes that it takes to really be a good entrepreneur. Because an idea is nothing if you don't have all the qualities of an entrepreneur that will make the idea succeed.
Okay, true. And what is one important quality that you expect that they should always have?
I think perseverance. Perseverance and heart.
Okay.
Yeah. Like just a never-say-die attitude. Just continuous perseverance.
Okay, wonderful. I'm moving on to the next segment of this episode, rapid fire questions. Let me just bring on. What's the best thing that happened to you this month?
My daughter got an opportunity to work with Zendesk in the US.
Okay, wonderful. Nice, congrats. What's your favorite subject in school?
Geography.
Okay, that is unique. Which book or article you have read recently and you liked?
I read Elon Musk's book on his journey, and I think that was really rewarding for me because it helped me to understand, although I'm into the space of education, that how education not necessarily leads to success, right? I mean, it's one part of what might lead to success, but oftentimes your journey as a young child and as a young adult is what can lead to success. So I just enjoyed that.
Okay, wonderful. If you want to go back and change one decision in your entrepreneurial journey, being an angel investor and other roles that you're performing, what would that decision be?
I should not have quit as an entrepreneur after 9 years and become an investor. I think I should have just continued on that journey.
Okay. What time you sleep and wake up in the morning, and how does your first few hours of morning look like?
Sleep normally around midnight, wake up at about 6:30. And first hour is always dedicated to some kind of physical workout. Could be yoga or like a walk or a run or something, some kind of physical workout. And after that, a little bit of time with family, because I like to start the day with breakfast and family. And then work begins, and then I don't look back.
Okay, nice. Who are your mentors, and how do you make sure that your mentors are available to you when you need them?
I've got two or three mentors that I really look up to. One is a gentleman called Abhay Havaldar. Another one is a gentleman called Anurag Saxena, based in Singapore. And I think I don't only reach out to them when I need support on a particular idea or thought. For me, mentorship is just guidance, right? So I'm in touch with them all the time. For me, it's mm-hmm. not about reaching out to them that, oh, I was thinking about this and what are your thoughts on it. I want them to know my thoughts on a weekly or monthly basis, just so that they kind of track where I am at. And they have so much to offer me just in terms of the world view, not just in terms of, you know, my little life and what I'm trying to do. So for me, mentorship is more not so much just about my life, but just guidance about my place in the world, you know, and how I can work in a way that I can be impactful to a lot of different people and lives. So I just enjoy that process. For me, it's a call every week and month that I just really look forward.
Okay, wonderful. Now you're interacting with multiple startups. You hear out the ideas before most of the people actually know about what is happening in the startup, in especially in edtech industry. So what's your vision that you see down the line 5 years in edtech space?
One of the things that I see because of the new education policy is a great focus on early childhood. So I think, you know, our preschool mm-hmm. and early childhood will go through a transformation, and I'm really looking forward to the transformation in that space. The other space is, us being more open to foreign universities, because I believe that it's time for us to bring in best practices. So dual degree and twinning programs and, having foreign universities come up and set up campus so that, you know, outside of our IITs and IIMs, which only a small proportion of our kids are able to afford from a learning standpoint, right? Because not everybody cracks the IIT and the IIM exams. We can have...
True.
Affordable but good quality education for many, many more students in the country.
Okay, that's wonderful. Last question in this episode. People who don't know about you and your foundation, where should they look for? How can they find you?
Yeah, so the foundation is, wfglobal.org. That's our website, and I think it contains all our information. We are always available here to help. Me personally, it's monica.mehta@wfglobal.org. And if they want to reach out to me personally, it's mehtamonikak@gmail.com. Always happy to, support young entrepreneurs if they ever want to reach out and, I need any support, help, inputs, anything that I can possibly give. Always around to help.
That's wonderful. I thoroughly enjoyed the complete hour that you spent and shared all your experience and knowledge, Monica. Thank you so much for spending the time with me.
Free-flowing conversation, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay, we are at the end of episode number 16. Thank you very much, Monica, for coming on and sharing your experiences. To our listeners, you can find out the episode summary in the description. Until we catch up soon with more exciting stories, stay tuned, be motivated. Thank you.